Thank you.
Can I get a sense from you of what your first memory is of being interested in mathematics or doing something mathematical?
Well, I was interested in math certainly from first grade. At least that's my first memory. I went to an unusual elementary school that was a lab school associated with Teachers College in New York, Teachers College part of Columbia University. Uh-huh. The thing about the school was that it was very much self-directed study, and so there were various self-guided learning. So there was self-guided reading and math. And while I did the reading, and that was fine, I got very much involved with the math and sort of quickly went through all the different levels that were available to me at each stage.
So was there a particular thing in mathematics that caught your attention?
I don't remember at that age. I remember I liked it. And I remember when I was about 8, my father took my sister and me into a bookstore and said we could pick out a book. And I found a book that was called The Magic House of Numbers. And I was able to read it. And one thing that I thought was, that really struck me in that book and that I still remember, is that it taught you a way of multiplying numbers in the range 6 to 10 times each other on your fingers, which meant that I didn't have to memorize the multiplication tables. Yeah. And so I learned how to do that from the book, and then I quickly learned how to do it visually in my head, so that rather than memorizing the multiplication tables, mm-hmm. I would imagine myself doing these mm-hmm. things with my fingers, and that would enable me to figure out what the product of two numbers was. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in New York City then?
I did. I grew up in Manhattan.
Uh-huh. Was your own family encouraging your interest in mathematics or sharing it at all?
No. I mean, they weren't discouraging, but they weren't encouraging.
Uh-huh.
So
no dinner time conversation.
Not
about
at all.
Math
No. Neither of my parents were interested at all in mathematics, mm-hmm. and they were divorced. And anyway, it didn't come up.
Uh-huh. When you went to high school, then did that interest, was it nurtured further or?
So I went through this elementary school, went through sixth grade, and then starting in seventh grade, I went to a pretty normal school. It was a private school in New York. I had sort of gone ahead on my own mathematically. So starting in seventh grade, I was in the ninth grade math. So I was a bit accelerated that way. And yes, definitely there was more encouragement from the teachers. Whereas in elementary school, the teachers were kind of preoccupied with the kids who were discipline problems, mm-hmm. and I was sitting there with my math books, so they didn't either encourage or discourage. And there were no exams and no grades, mm-hmm. so, you know, I knew I was more advanced than other kids in math, but it wasn't really, it was just my thing. It wasn't interacting with it, with the teachers.
So so when you're nearing the end of the high school years, was math the direction you're already interested in at that
point? Oh, very much so.
So when you were looking for a college?
I didn't really, so one thing is I graduated high school after 11th grade, okay. So I was young, I turned 17 in August before, is that right? Yeah, I think so. I turned 17 in August before I started college. So mm-hmm. I was a year younger. Mm-hmm. But also when I was in high school, there really wasn't, I didn't have much advice mm-hmm. about college. There was a guidance counselor in the school who we didn't meet with, who just gave each of us a sheet of paper with schools that we should apply to. And my parents weren't involved. And so basically I applied to a school because I knew a girl who went there who lived in my apartment building. So I didn't really think, the concept that some schools might be better than others for math didn't really occur to me.
And so you ended up at Hamilton College?
It was actually Kirkland at the time. So I went to the girls' school.
Ah.
So this girl who lived in my building was a few years older. She had gone there. And I went there, and I really didn't think about anything ahead of time, like the fact that the way Kirkland was set up as a sister school of Hamilton, all of the subjects that were already strong at Hamilton were not offered at Kirkland, because you could take classes either way. So there was no math at Kirkland. And so there were almost no students interested in math in Kirkland, because they were sort of more aware than I was when they were applying to schools. So this was something that didn't even cross my mind until I got there.
So how did you navigate through all of that?
Well, I mean, I was the only girl, I think, in virtually all of my math classes. There was one girl I knew who was a year older than me, and one girl I knew who was a year younger than me. But there weren't any other girls my age. For the most part, the faculty were encouraging, and the fact that it was at Hamilton instead of Kirkland wasn't really a big deal. I had one very unfortunate experience with an older professor who would always address us as boys, and would always make references to how we knew we wanted to be out playing football and things like that. And he also specifically, I got something like a B on the first exam, and he told me that I should stop taking math, that I really didn't have what it took. So, and he retired the year after. But it was traumatic for me then, but it wasn't so traumatic that it made me give up math.
Did you have interests outside of math too? Are there other subjects?
Not so much. So here's the problem, back to my elementary school,
yes.
is that because of the fact that it was this free-for-all,
yes.
I didn't really learn very much outside of math and how to read. So when I went to middle school and high school, I was extremely unprepared in almost every area. I couldn't spell, didn't know where any countries were on a map, didn't know the simplest things about American history, I had never sat through a lecture, taken an exam, nothing. And so math, okay, I was taking exams and whatnot, but because I was very accelerated, it wasn't stressful. It wasn't really anything. I don't think I knew how to study. I just took the exams. But in the other subjects, I really struggled and never felt confident. I didn't know, like, the parts of speech or anything about writing. And so I never really considered any other field other than math.
And yet you needed to develop some of those skills anyway to get through college.
Which, yeah, you know, I did to a certain extent. But by much self-teaching, let's say.
Were there particular aspects of mathematics that sort of attracted your attention or that you really found?
Well, I always liked the visual. Okay, just like back when I was learning the multiplication and I was visualizing my fingers. So you know, in, I guess it was probably eighth grade or something when I took geometry, I really loved that. In college, actually, the class I had with that older man was geometry class, which was sort of unfortunate. I mean, it was non-Euclidean. Right. But in any case, so I did like that. And I liked topology when I took that. I did a senior thesis on set theory, which originally, like, I really enjoyed my senior thesis. I very much enjoyed working with the professor that I did that with. And I originally intended to do set theory in graduate school. But that isn't what happened.
So was graduate school almost inevitable?
I pretty much just assumed I would go to graduate school. At some point when I was younger, maybe in high school, I had thought about, did I want to be a high school math teacher? And I saw the behavior problems that, you know, that most of the kids didn't have my interest in math, and it was very hard for the teacher. Particularly, we had a woman teacher who was, she had a hard time controlling the boys. And that didn't seem appealing to me. And so pretty much from college, I thought I would be a college math professor. And so I never really doubted that I would go to graduate school. Although it doesn't mean that I really conceptualized very much about what that would mean.
Yeah.
So
how did you go about looking for a graduate school?
Well, again, I just was basically told what to do, you know, so I had a professor who was my advisor, not my senior thesis advisor, but sort of I'd had him in multiple classes and so on. He wasn't even my academic advisor because we had academic advisors at Kirkland. There were no math people there.
Right.
I had a history of science advisor at Kirkland. But in any case, he had gone to the University of Wisconsin, and he very much thought I should go there, and that seemed fine to me. I mean, I really had no basis. You know, of course, before the internet or anything, it wasn't so easy to look up anything, and he said that that was a good place to go, and, you know, I applied, and I got in, and I got a TA-ship, and it seemed like a good place to go. You know, I also got into Berkeley. I mean, I applied to maybe five schools, and I also got into Berkeley, but the TA-ship that Berkeley offered was only guaranteed for 1 year, and the one at Wisconsin was guaranteed for four or five, I can't remember. And also, he thought I should go to Wisconsin, and so I did.
So did you end up finding what you were looking for at Wisconsin?
I had a really good experience in a certain sense. It was certainly, let's say socially, it was much better for me than college. When I was in college, I was very much the nerdy girl in a situation where almost none of the girls at Kirkland were nerdy, were into math or anything. And also it was a period of the, you know, second wave of feminism where there was this kind of like back to the earth, like the girls who wear long flowing dresses and be into their womanliness. And so I was accused sort of regularly of being male identified because of the fact that I was interested in math. That was like I was, quote, trying to become a man from their point of view. So it was not so great for me socially. And then I went to Wisconsin, and even though I was one of the few women math graduate students, in fact, in my entering class, there were 40-something. Three of us were women, but the other two dropped out before even the middle of the first semester. So they were pretty much gone. I don't remember their names or anything. So there weren't a lot of women, and yet the male graduate students were much more accepting of me than the men at Hamilton, who had a different image of what a girl should be. And at the same time, I was in Wisconsin at the time. They had a active teaching assistants association, which I was a member of. And through that and other things, I met a lot of graduate students who weren't in math and had friends, female friends, who were graduate students in other fields, and who totally accepted me, you know, wearing pants all the time or whatever. And you know, so socially it was much better than college had been. So mathematically, I had some challenges. So I was originally interested in both topology and logic. Logic was it was not very comfortable for me. I felt it was very male dominated, which is very funny because everything was male dominated. Although Mary Ellen Rudin was my first topology teacher, so that there was some female presence in that sense. But in among the logic students, it seemed much more competitive and I don't know, not as welcoming. And I didn't really feel that comfortable in that group. And I also became more interested in the topology. Like, I sort of had gotten this idea of going into logic because of my set theory thesis as an undergraduate, but as I learned more logic, it didn't seem to draw on this visual thing that I really liked, whereas the topology did. And so I went in topology. And by contrast with the logic students, the graduate students in topology were very welcoming, and I felt almost like it was a personality difference. Like, the ones in topology were more what I would call laid back and relaxed, and everybody would help everybody and so on, and that was appealing to me.
So when it came for time for a thesis?
Well, that was challenging also. So I worked with someone. Shortly after I became a student, he went on sabbatical for the year to the University of Texas at Austin, and I went with him. Which was actually a good experience. There were a lot more topology students there, and I interacted with some of the topology faculty there, although I still, in terms of research, wasn't really making any progress on anything. I didn't really have a problem. And then he did eventually give me a paper to read, my advisor did, And I figured out how to generalize something in that. We were back at Wisconsin at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, I had, while I was in Austin for the year, I'd met and lived with a woman who was a graduate student in German, just
mm-hmm.
randomly, and we'd become very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my, when I first went back to Wisconsin, and I was doing, I was like generalizing this paper, I, for some vacation, which could have been Thanksgiving, I can't really remember, I decided rather than going home to New York, I would go to visit my friend in German graduate school
mm-hmm.
in Austin. So I went down to spend that time with her. And while I was there, of course, she was working. So I went to the math department
mm-hmm.
to hang out. And I met a new postdoc there at the time in topology. And he asked me what I was doing. And I told him about this thing I was generalizing, whatever. And he said, you know, what you're saying could relate to this open problem that Fox had written about in his list of problems in the 60s. And so, you know, have you thought about that? And I, of course, had not.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ended up being my thesis. I mean, I did the, my thesis did, was both of those things, the
mm-hmm.
generalization I'd done, as well as the solution to that problem that Fox had asked, which was
mm-hmm.
sort of more interesting in a wider sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of, you know, serendipity or something that I met him. And frankly, the, that man was an Australian mathematician who went back to Australia after
mm-hmm.
his postdoc, and I have not seen him since.
Mm-hmm.
But although I thanked him and so on, you know.
Yeah.
But in any case, so things did work out.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a little bit of time there where I wasn't sure how things would work out.
So what kind of position were you looking for after graduate school?
Well, I always wanted to be at a small liberal arts college because of the fact
okay.
that I'd had this, in spite of, again, that older man, I'd had a great experience
mm-hmm.
at Hamilton with most of the people there
mm-hmm.
In the math department. And... that really seemed like what I wanted to do. I had that in my head without, like I didn't ever really doubt that. When I was graduating, I applied for everything. I mean, it was a bad job market then. This was in 1983. So I applied for lots of tenure track jobs and I applied for postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a post, I mean, I also had a, at least maybe two offers, I can't really remember, from tenure track jobs that weren't ideal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a offer from Rice University as a postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
And although I actually had not enjoyed being in Texas, I mean, I enjoyed the math department and my good friends and so on,
right.
that I wasn't really into the Texas culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I when I came back to Wisconsin, I told my friends I didn't want to live in Texas. But then when I got this postdoc, I did go to Texas, to Houston for 2 years,
uh-huh.
on that postdoc, and it was during that time, again, a matter of serendipity, when I attended an AMS meeting, which was not in Texas, but anyway, where I heard a lecture by John Simon from the University of Iowa about topology and chemistry. Because that certainly wasn't what I was doing. I was doing basically symmetries of knots and three manifolds.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was talking about topology and chemistry, and symmetry was part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't know any chemistry. It was one of those things. I had taken it
mm-hmm.
in high school. I had not taken it in college. But I didn't really know very much. But I thought his talk was interesting, because certainly I'd thought of topology as very pure
mm-hmm.
and so on. And... at the end of his talk, I asked a question, I can't remember what it was at this
mm-hmm.
point, and I had a conversation with him. And about a week later, when I went back to Rice, he called me.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that he and a chemist were applying for a grant, a big grant, and they wanted me to be part of their team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite shocked, and I said, I don't know any chemistry, and I don't want to pretend like I do. And he said, oh no, that's okay. You know, you can write this part of the grant, and you want to be write part
mm-hmm.
of the grant, you write this part of the grant that has to do with symmetries of knots. And the proposal had to do with symmetries of molecules, and then we'll incorporate it in. So it was within the kind of thing I knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did, and we got the grant. And then he began to be invited to chemistry conferences because he was doing this thing. And I was considered his postdoc, even though I was at Rice, he was in Iowa. But from the chemistry point of view, I was a postdoc and he was a professor, and so I was his postdoc. And so every time he got invited to a conference, I would be invited to give a poster. And so I would do that. And I would pick up stuff about chemistry by attending the lectures.
These would be at chemistry conferences.
Yeah, these would be at chemistry conferences. Mostly like mathematical chemistry, or sometimes more generally, but anyway. And then he had the unfortunate experience of becoming chair, not only of the math department at that time, but also of the computer science department that was having trouble. And he stopped going to conferences for 3 years or 6 years, I can't really remember. And so then I began to be invited to give talks. And so I did that. And eventually I, well, I got married somewhere in there, and I mean, before all that. But then we spent a semester in 1996 at in Paris at the Institut Henri Poincaré, where I was giving a series of lectures. It was a mini course, essentially geared at graduate students on topology and chemistry. And I had put together, I spent a lot of time putting together that course and giving these lectures. And afterwards, I thought, well, what am I going to do with these notes? It wasn't a course that I could give at Pomona, where I was at the time, because we didn't sort of have room in the curriculum. Sorry.
So where did you get, at what point did you get to Pomona?
Oh, I forgot that. Sorry. Yes. Okay, backtrack. So then I was at, so I was on a the Evans whatever instructorship.
Two-year postdoc, right.
It was two, but it was really three. It was supposed to be three, but I only stayed for two because in the third year, there was a special year in topology at UC Santa Barbara. And so I went there. In the meantime, in the summer between my first and second year at Rice, I had gone to a topology workshop in England where I met my husband, who's also a topologist. And he's French, and at the time he had a job in France. And so we, while I was at Rice, for the next year at Rice, we did this sort of writing letters. There was no email, and phones were expensive. So we did the writing letters and so on. And then we decided to try to be together. And so when I was at Santa Barbara for that year, I was actually there only the fall and winter quarters. He joined me in the winter quarter, and then the spring quarter we were in Paris. But during the fall quarter, we applied for jobs, and during the with the intention of being together. During the winter quarter, we did interviewing and whatnot, and he really wanted to be somewhere where he would have graduate students. He was very research-oriented. In fact, he hadn't taught prior to that. And I wanted to be at a small liberal arts college, and so we tried to pair things up. And so we did, I got the job at Pomona, and he got a job at University of Southern California, where he's been since, and I've been here since. So that's, so I joined the faculty there in 1986, fall of 86.
Now, before we get back
yes,
to the book, a big part of being at a small liberal arts college is the teaching part. So that had been developing.
Yes, I guess I hadn't mentioned that. Very much so. So back when I was in Wisconsin, originally everybody, I mean the first years, we were all teaching assistants for a huge calculus class. We would lead problem sessions a couple of times a week. But if you were interested and possibly had jumped through some hoops, like passing qualifiers or whatever, I can't really remember, then you were allowed to teach your own class if it was a either algebra, trig, or pre-algebra. So I began doing that. I taught algebra, and you would teach like two sections that met three times a week, and there was no TA or anything. And I really enjoyed that, teaching my own class. I was already enjoying very much being a TA, but it was certainly more fun to teach my own class. And I became involved with, there was a program at the time at Wisconsin that was called Minorities in Engineering. And I don't remember exactly how I did this, but I had the idea that that basically the students would do better. So the minorities in engineering, sometimes they would struggle. I had the idea that they would do better if they were in sort of their own class, and instead of meeting three times a week, we would meet 5 days a week, and do sort of challenging worksheets during class. Okay, and I, you know, this wasn't really in the grapevine at the time. I mean, we're talking, I got my PhD in 83, so this must have been like 79 or sometime like that. I can't really remember. So anyway, I had this idea and I hand wrote out various worksheets about doing algebra. It was algebra. So I had my own class, and I believe I, instead of having two classes of algebra, I had one class, but we met 5 days a week. We did these worksheets and everything, and the students did well in that. And so I was pretty excited about that, and continued to work in the Minorities in Engineering program for the other years I was there. When I was in Austin, there's another year in here that I didn't mention, but when I was in Austin, I taught, like, again, an algebra class instead of, oh, and I think one semester I did the TA thing with calculus, and one semester I did algebra. There was another year in this, which was actually 79-80, where for various reasons I ended up spending that year at the University of Pennsylvania. So I went on leave. I mean, it largely had to do with a romantic interest, which is not not the person I'm with right now, but in any case, and he went there, and anyway, and it was closer to home, and so I didn't quit graduate school or apply to Penn. I just basically took a leave from Wisconsin, and at that time, Penn needed TAs, mm-hmm. and so they, even though I wasn't officially a student, they were happy mm-hmm. for me to be a TA, and I had, like, really great, whatever, letters about yes. my teaching, and so I was a TA in the fall at Penn, and then in the spring, they asked me if I would teach they had continuing education or something mm-hmm. for adults, and it was in the night. I mean, it would be twice a week for something like 2.5 or 3 hours, and so they asked me to teach that, which was actually a big class. It might have been 50 or 75 mm-hmm. students, most of them older, but not, like, they might have been 25 to 30. Mm-hmm. They were, like, they had jobs. And so I had my own calculus class doing that. And I enjoyed that, although it was very much a lecture format, because, mm-hmm. and we didn't have TA sections or anything. And then I believe that in the summer, I can't remember which summer, but sometime after that, I also taught my own calculus class, mm-hmm. a small class, at Wisconsin. But the one that I most enjoyed was that Minorities in Engineering, where I was able mm-hmm. to design worksheets and get to know the students. It was a small class. Mm-hmm. There might have been 25 students, or maybe even only 20, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And also, a lot of those students had really not the best experience with math in high school, mm-hmm. even though they were interested in engineering. And they really appreciated that they finally understood all these things. And mm-hmm. so that made me feel like I really had something to give them. So, yes.
And you're still at Pomona?
Oh, so now I'm at Pomona. Yeah, so we jumped ahead. So various things happened with teaching. When I was at Rice, I won a teaching award that wasn't in the math department, that was, like, college-wide. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Santa Barbara. I didn't win a teaching award, but I had some parent who was trying to get them to hire me tenure track because her kid thought I was so great or whatever. Yeah. So there were various things, again, about teaching. Yeah. And then I came to Pomona, as I said, in 86, and I have been there ever since. Yeah. So, and I'm still there.
So it's clearly a good environment for you.
It's right. It's, I mean, the students are so wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's been terrific. Mm-hmm. In the summers since 2000, most summers since 2000, I have been teaching in the program called the Summer Math Program, which is at Carleton College. It's a program for freshmen and sophomore women that's mm-hmm. run by Deanna Hounsberger and Stephen Kennedy. And that has also been wonderful in a different way. Mm-hmm. I had actually, in 94, the summer of 94, I taught in the, I think it was called the Summer Math Institute, which was a similar program mm-hmm. at Berkeley and Mills mm-hmm. for women between junior and senior year. But I thought that the one at Carleton was much better. I was much more impressed and very, very committed to it. I mean, mm-hmm. I felt like it really made a difference to the students, and we have a tremendous mm-hmm. number of former students who are now mathematicians, mm-hmm. and it's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. And I attribute a lot of that, or all of that, to Steve and Deanna. I feel like the organization has and planning that has gone into it really is incredibly successful.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now we can get back to you.
Oh, sorry.
How did that come about?
Oh, yes. Yeah, so, So I gave this course. This was in 96 in Paris. And I had these notes that I spent an enormous amount of time writing. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to use it to teach a course at Pomona because we had to cover the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is kind of a specialized mm-hmm. course. It wouldn't be a standard course at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the idea of making it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And so originally, I think I wrote a prospectus and three chapters and sent it to Cambridge
mm-hmm.
University Press. And they were interested in publishing it. And after the whole thing was done, they wrote to me and said that they were teaming up with the MAA
mm-hmm.
for a new series
mm-hmm.
called Outlooks, and would I be willing to have my book be part of that? And I said, sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it happened.
Okay. Now, through this time with the teaching
yes.
and the book and so on, how did your research evolve?
Well, the research evolved well. I mean, I sort of continued to do things that had to do with chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Although it sort of came and went depending on interest of chemists.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my work that has to do with chemistry really came from some question from a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And so otherwise, I worked in more pure topology, but I sort of spearheaded or pioneered in a certain sense the field of what's called spatial graphs, which is graphs in space. So graph theory is the field of abstract graphs. And spatial graphs came from the idea of molecules.
Mm-hmm.
So and of course, John Simon, whose lecture stimulated me, was the, I think, first person who was really looking at that. I mean, apart from some other people who had results that were not part of a big body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And so after getting into from the chemistry point of view, and having my background in knot theory,
mm-hmm.
I had the idea that a lot of the kinds of things that are studied in knot theory could be studied
mm-hmm.
for graphs in space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have done quite a bit of work in that area, even though it's not necessarily connected to molecules.
But it is sort of connected to knots in knot theory.
Yes. And some of it actually has to do with knots, but
mm-hmm.
some of it has to do with symmetries and things that have to do with these graphs
mm-hmm.
in space and not always in
mm-hmm.
not always in R3, in other three
mm-hmm.
manifolds and so on.
Uh-huh.
So, and I've also written or been part of a couple other books. So there's an edited book that was part of a short course in the AMS that
mm-hmm.
I ran together with Dorothy Buck
mm-hmm.
on applications of knot theory. And Dorothy Buck is a former student of mine from Pomona who she studies DNA topology, and she's at Imperial College London. And so the two of us organized that short course, and then we edited a book
mm-hmm.
of articles from there, which included each of our own articles. But then I also co-wrote a book with two other people on number theory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a book that's published by Wiley, so it's a mainstream
mm-hmm.
Book that is called, I think, An Introduction to Number Theory with Proofs, Applications, and Stories. And it's a little bit of an unusual book, largely because of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So they are fictitious stories that are that use real historical figures,
mm-hmm.
but in ways that are clearly fictitious, like
mm-hmm.
when Gauss is abducted by aliens and
mm-hmm.
taken to Mars and so on, and that the stories would create a mathematical
mm-hmm.
problem that the chapter would then
mm-hmm.
solve.
Right.
So we incorporated these stories in to make it more sort of light and fun for the
mm-hmm.
students. And there's all kinds of puns and whatnot
mm-hmm.
in the stories. The other thing that makes that number theory book different is that we incorporate like an introduction to proofs in the
mm-hmm.
book, so with the idea that it could be used for an intro to proofs class. It could also be used for a class for future teachers, because it does the proofs and then it does the number theory. And even though it does go through sort of quite a lot of number theory, you don't have to cover all the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured it could be useful in different
mm-hmm.
in different ways. So I'm the third author on that. There are two others. Jamie Pomersham is the lead author, who's a number theorist. And then Tim Marks, who ended up leaving mathematics, and he works for Mitsubishi. So that book came about because Jamie Pomersham was in my department, and I had just finished this book when he joined the department,
mm-hmm.
and he was impressed that I had done this book, and
mm-hmm.
he and Tim Marks, this other guy, had been working on this number theory book and actually not making any progress for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "We need you
mm-hmm.
on this book." And so I ended up working with him on the book.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, and now I'm in the process of writing another book.
Mm-hmm.
So the book I'm currently writing is grew out of the course I teach in the summer math program,
mm-hmm.
Which is really an introduction to topology and its application for students with no prerequisites.
Mm-hmm.
So this book is at the level of like a junior undergraduate who's taken real analysis,
mm-hmm.
whereas the other book, it's really just intuitive. There's nothing formal in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I developed this set of notes by teaching this course for many years. And then what happened is I was asked to lead the undergraduate faculty program at PCMI one summer when there was a topology theme. And what I decided, and they asked me if I could do something with the undergraduate faculty that would lead to a book. And I had the idea of taking these notes, which I developed,
mm-hmm.
and then expanding them into something, because the notes were for a 1 month
mm-hmm.
intensive course, but to expand it into a much more complete
mm-hmm.
Textbook. And so what I did is the notes at that time were, there were essentially 12 chapters,
mm-hmm.
and I had a group of 18 faculty that I helped choose to be in the program. I divided them into six groups of three, and assigned each group of three two chapters that were not consecutive, that were six away from each other in
wow.
this book, and in the notes, and I gave them all the notes,
mm-hmm.
and we would meet for most of all day for the
mm-hmm.
life of the 3 weeks of the program, and expand what I had as notes by giving sort of more examples and going off in other directions and taking the problems I had and adding more problems and so on until we had a fairly large collection of notes, and the different groups took turns presenting it in that program to a group that was composed of high school teachers and college freshmen
mm-hmm.
to sort of test it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had this collection, which I sort of had watched develop, but the different chapters
mm-hmm.
were sort of written in different voices. And,
right.
and anyway, and so then I spent, so this was in 2011, that this program, so then I spent the next, let's say, 2 years taking those notes and making it longer and more cohesive
mm-hmm.
and so on. And then the AMS had a contract with PCMI
mm-hmm.
to publish whatever they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, which was a year ago, it will be a year this December, so December 2013, I submitted that manuscript
mm-hmm.
to the AMS, and they had it reviewed, and they decided to publish it with suggested revisions. And then since then, I've been working on the revisions,
mm-hmm.
and I'm hoping to be done,
mm-hmm.
not, I mean, doing more than what they asked, including adding some additional chapters.
Right.
I'm hoping to be done by this Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and then it will appear. But in the meantime, because of the fact that we had these 18 people involved, many of those people have used the notes
mm-hmm.
in courses at their own institutions. And so that's been good as well.
So this is an introduction to topology that you're talking about.
Yeah, so it's
it's
not a standard introduction at
that's
all.
That's what I, yeah.
Yeah, so this book is called, From Molecules to the Universe,
mm-hmm.
An Introduction to Topology. And so it's, the book starts out talking about sort of flat land and how two-dimensional creatures could figure out properties of their universe.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some of the same material that's in Jeff Weeks's book, in the first
mm-hmm.
half of Jeff Weeks's book,
mm-hmm.
but it's sort of at a both maybe higher and lower level.
Mm-hmm.
Higher in the sense that it actually has formal definitions,
mm-hmm.
formal in an intuitive sense,
mm-hmm. right.
definitions, which Jeff's book doesn't have, but also more informal in the sense that it's very playful. There's characters. There's like,
mm-hmm.
that may be coming from the number theory book idea, but anyway, A square, and he has a relationship
mm-hmm.
with B triangle, and there's little things that
mm-hmm.
they do, and so there's a lot of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the first, the first seven chapters have to do with understanding two-dimensional universes and how that helps us understand three-dimensional universes, and even how do we understand the fourth dimension in that. And then starting in chapter 8, 9, and 10 is some knot theory.
Mm-hmm.
At, again, that same level with formal definitions, but still with some characters and things like that, little stories and stuff. Not by no means a comprehensive
mm-hmm.
introduction to knot theory, in some ways inspired by Colin Adams' book.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so that's chapters 8, 9, and 10. Then chapters 11 and 12 are more or less inspired by my
mm-hmm.
book about molecules and so on. Chapter 13 and 14 will be, those are the new chapters,
mm-hmm.
will be, 13 is the sort of topology of proteins, and 14 is the topology of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not so much cutesy stories, but again, at a very informal level, which I don't think there's much available about that material at this level. So it doesn't have the definition of a topology. Like, it's not in any sense... even among the more elementary books that are undergraduate topology,
right.
it's not like that at all. There's no definition of open sets,
mm-hmm.
no definition of continuity. None of that comes up at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's all intuitive and combinatorial
mm-hmm.
in its nature.
Actually sounds very attractive to me.
I think it is.
Yeah.
You know, one of the ideas of this is that for schools that don't have a lot of math majors,
mm-hmm.
that you can't have a very hierarchical program where
mm-hmm.
this comes before this becomes,
yeah.
you know. And so the idea would be to teach a topology course that students who are interested in math at any level could take. So
mm-hmm.
advanced students could benefit as well as beginning students.
Or perhaps even a chemistry student.
For example. Okay. And I should say that a couple of things also have influenced this. One is that for a couple of years, I did co-teach a course with a chemist at Pomona that was an elective course on symmetry
mm-hmm.
of molecules mostly, but from a topology point of view as well as a molecular point of view. The other thing is, maybe this didn't influence it, but a little bit has something to do with it. I've been part of the CUPM, the,
mm-hmm.
the new one,
right.
and I led the team developing topology courses.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, although that came after the PCMI, but before
right.
I was done with the book, we were looking at what kinds of topology courses would be appropriate at different schools. And while, you know, I'm in a kind of elite school where all students take real analysis, and
mm-hmm.
so that's a prerequisite for topology, most schools are not like that. And so we were exploring what
mm-hmm.
could be possible. And, you know, one direction would be to have a course like Colin Adams' Knot book.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is this would be a little broader. It would
mm-hmm.
give them a more comprehensive view of the types of things that topology could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our description of different types of topology courses, we included something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we listed books, and of course my book wasn't listed because
right.
it didn't exist.
Right.
But anyway, that
mm-hmm.
is how that came up. And I also led the team for the CUPM on coordination with chemistry.
Uh-huh.
So then also I sort of thought about this in that context, as you said, that chemistry students could
mm-hmm.
take it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have done senior theses a couple of times. We do senior theses at Pomona. I've done a couple of them with students who were double math and chemistry majors, mm-hmm. and who were very much interested in this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that also motivated me.
Interesting. So I guess finally, where do you see yourself 5 years, 10 years from now?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. Things, I feel like very much in my life there's been serendipity, mm-hmm. right? Things that I hadn't planned, like when I was invited to teach at the summer math program, right. which has become very much a part of my life mm-hmm. that I didn't even know about, and the chemistry thing. So I really don't know mm-hmm. where that will go. I certainly, this book that I'm working on should be published by
yes.
then,
okay.
definitely. I don't have any, well, I sort of don't have any specific other book projects. I actually do have one, which is quite different again. So another thing I've done over the years, partly because of my interest in chemistry, is some time ago, let's see, in 1999, I sort of had become friends with the chemists at Pomona and was aware of the fact that, you know, Pomona is a high-level school. We've got really great students. Mm-hmm. But some students, a small number of students, come in without the quantitative skills to be able to succeed in chemistry. Mm-hmm. And back then, there was a course called pre-calculus that we offered that very few students took because they took pre-calculus in high school. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was remedial. They didn't want to take it. And in addition to that, the students who struggled in chemistry, that pre-calculus course didn't really help them. Mm-hmm. Because that course was like about functions and, you know,
right.
all that pre-calculus material. And that wasn't what they had difficulty with in chemistry. And so I had the idea that what they needed was to be able to use the math that they already knew from high school in an applied context.
Mm-hmm.
And so really it was about word problems.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to see how to use
mm-hmm.
how to use their math skills in an applied context,
mm-hmm.
and so at that time I spearheaded a CCLI grant that we got to, which was called enhancing, I think it was called, or fostering the success of students in chemistry or something
mm-hmm.
like that, or the mathematical something or background, etc. So what we did with that grant was, first of all, we wrote a new placement exam for general chemistry, because the previous one, well, it was primarily math, but it wasn't primarily word problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the idea that what we needed to test to see if they were ready for chemistry was their ability to solve word problems, not specific things like the quadratic formula or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one thing we did. And then I also developed a course that I called problem solving, which would be aimed at the students who didn't do well on that exam,
mm-hmm.
to teach them how to solve problems and to sort of just do a variety of different types of applications, not just chemistry, but that used things that they supposedly knew but maybe didn't know that well, like logarithms and exponents and trigonometry. And so I developed that class and taught it for, let's say, 10 years. And then something began happening which I don't have a real explanation for this, but where students didn't want to take the class. So I had actually extremely excellent evaluations of the class. Because again, these were students who really struggled and felt like this really helped them. But what was happening, starting at, let's say, 3 or 4 years ago, is that the freshmen would be told, okay, you didn't do well on this exam. We recommend that you take this class, but Pomona is very much, we don't force anyone to do anything. And the students would say, oh, I don't want to, quote, get behind. I want to start out in calculus like everybody else. And they would do that, and they would do poorly in calculus and chemistry. And nonetheless, the next group of freshmen would do it. And this has sort of been going on for, like I say, about 3 years. And so I had the idea that, well, the problem is it's not a calculus course. And so if I incorporated calculus, then they would not they would take it because they would think, you know, well, it is calculus. I'm not getting behind. And so, but then I thought, well, if I'm going to incorporate calculus, I have to pare down what I'm doing. And so what I did that I had never done at the beginning when I was developing the course is I actually spent a lot of time talking to and reading online about what mathematics students actually use in these courses. Mm. So in the when I developed the problem-solving course and the exam originally, I just sort of put together a list of topics that were from algebra, trig, geometry, pre-calculus, and gave it to the chemistry department and said, check off which ones you think they should know. Mm-hmm. And then I'd taken those and developed problems. Okay. But they weren't problems that the students would actually see in the class. Okay, so that's not what I did this time. So this time, this past summer, I started out meeting with them and talking to them and talking to economics, because before it was all about science, and now I thought, well, economics has the same problem with their students not having the quantitative skills. And so I began to gather problems both from faculty in the disciplines and also online reading, looking at the problems that students actually solve in these various classes of physics also, and seeing what things they actually need. And not only what things they need in sort of not calculus, but what aspects of calculus they need. And so what I did is I took the actual normal first semester calculus curriculum and only picked out topics where they actually seem to be applying these in their science and economics classes, and then took these problems that were actual science and economics problems and restructured the entire, what I would call first half of the class, the non-calculus class, so that it really is directly applied. It's not like the, you know, physics department said, well, we want trig, and then I make up trig problems. It's more like, here are actual problems that you would see in a class like this, which meant that I have to teach them a little bit of the sciences and teach them a little bit of the economics in order to explain what the where the problem even comes from. Anyway, so I restructured the class like that, and it's now called Calculus with Problem Solving. And I'm teaching for the first time right now. But I have the idea, possibly as a future book project, of developing a class that might be this, but actually might be more than this and go back to practical math. So it would be math that you really use, whether it be in sort of how you get, when you get a car loan, how do you compute how much your payments are going to be or whatever? So not in the university context, but in your own practical life, as well as what you would use in science and economics. And so it would span from a more elementary level than what I'm doing now, all the way through basic calculus one, but again, only carefully chosen topics. So that's sort of an idea that I have in the back of my head for a future book project. So I don't know in 5 years whether I will be working on that, but I could be. And frankly, I also have the idea, if I were going to do such a thing, that I would want to do it the way I am doing this book, the PCMI book, because I feel like that has been really good. That one problem with problem, but maybe also a good thing about most books is it's from one person's point of view. And so I develop a class, I have my students, I sort of know what their level is, and so on. And then other people are teaching totally different students and would use it in a totally different way, and I'd like to have their opinions too. And I felt like that really helped with the development of the PCMI book. But then you can't really write a book as a committee because it becomes very disjointed. And so now I'm taking several years to take that and unify it. And one thing that when the AMS was originally talking to me at PCMI about how are you going to do this, because it's you and these 18 people, what we agreed on that totally made sense to me, it was basically my idea, was that it will say Erica Flappin with, and then there are 18 authors in some box, and nobody gets royalties. All the royalties go to PCMI. Okay, so, you know, because we don't make money on royalty. I mean, and whatever. It doesn't make any sense to me to try to break up the royalties or whatever. And PCMI was what enabled this to happen. So I actually told PCMI and told the AMS that all the royalties will go to the part of PCMI for the undergraduate faculty program, which is what this was. So I would, if I were to develop a book that is the one I've just described to you, I would somehow want to be able to do something like that after I develop notes, which would be not for a while, but to be able to then bring aboard a bunch of people to expand it and then let me redo the whole thing so that it both has all the different needs of different people, but at the same time is all in one voice. So, anyway,
sounds
that's
like a very interesting project.
That's an idea.
Okay, well, thank you. Unless there's something you
I mean, I think I probably talked too much, but anyway, I need
some
more water.
Very nice. Thank you. You have some water.
Okay, terrific.